أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، بارئ الخلائق أجمعين، والصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين، سيدنا ونبينا وحبيب قلوبنا وطبيب نفوسنا وشفيع ذنوبنا أبي القاسم محمد. ثم الصلاة والسلام على آل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المظلومين، ولعنة الله على أعدائهم أجمعين من يوم عداوتهم إلى يوم الدين. أما بعد، فقد قال الله تبارك وتعالى في كتابه، بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم: إن الذين اتقوا إذا مسهم طائف من الشيطان تذكروا فإذا هم مبصرون. صلوات على محمد. We continue with our discussion on the root cause of negative suffering. And tonight we begin with a discussion on raising children and the question on whether it is possible to raise a child without this false nafs or ego that is the illusion that results in all the different forms of negative suffering. When we try and understand this from an Islamic perspective and we try and compare it with the way Allah created Adam alayhi salam, who is the prototype of man, we see that the formation of an ego is like the eating of the fruit by Adam from the tree. Because remember that Adam ala nabiyyina wa alayhi salam, when he was created, he did not have the benefit of being a baby and growing into an adult. He was created straight as an adult. So at first, he had the innocence of a child. And we see from the Quran as well that when Iblis, la'natullah alayhi, wants to mislead Adam, he swears in the name of Allah and tells him, I swear by Allah that if you eat from this tree, you will become immortals. And because Adam, he has this childlike innocence, he has never heard anybody say a lie, and he has never heard anyone swear in the name of Allah and lie. And so he believes him. The eating of that fruit is symbolic of the maturity that we acquire when we grow through puberty and become adults. So that fruit causes the loss of innocence, if you like. Because it is at that point that Adam becomes aware of his nakedness, and he hides behind trees and covers himself with leaves. When we look at the literature that human beings have produced across cultures and across religions, there is a common theme that you will see of this country boy or country girl who comes to the city and loses his or her innocence and goes through a phase where they acquire maturity, but they lose their innocence. And then with time, they either go on a path that leads to hell, so to speak, or they try and regain their original state of purity, but now with awareness and with maturity. And you will see this from your own experience as well. In places like Canada, we don't see that so much, because this being a large city and being extremely multicultured, our children, even when they stay with us, when they go to universities and they study, they acquire a certain level of maturity and understanding. But if you have lived in places that are comparatively smaller, where the culture is only one, where all the people belong to a certain group, even if they are Shias, they are all of one ethnicity, you will see a marked difference between the children who at some point leave and go abroad and study and come back versus those who stay there only. And the difference you will see is that those who stay back, and this is not to judge, there may be exceptions to the rule, depending on the parents and how they bring them up. But the marked difference you will see is that those who go out, again, the classic country boy goes to the city, when they come back, they are mature in their thought. They have the ability to analyze and to understand things at a deeper level. But they have less innocence. And the one who stays behind and who is sheltered and protected, you will see they don't have the depth. They don't have the maturity. They don't have the tolerance. They tend to be very narrow-minded. But at the same time, they have a certain purity and innocence. Allah's intention is not that the human being should remain innocent like a child. Allah's intention is this human being should remain pure, but with that depth and that maturity and that awareness, so that he or she can be a true representative of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala on this earth. So surrendering to Allah is returning to a state of purity with maturity after having lost it. And therefore, the creation of an ego is in some way like the eating of the fruit of Adam alayhi salam, as I said. And someone did ask me yesterday that if shaitan could have introduced the fear of death to Adam, who are we? And Adam was a prophet. So it's a lengthy discussion about whether, you know, especially as Shias, because we don't believe in prophets committing sins, and we have another concept of tarka awla. There is a whole debate to talk about how when Adam was in Jannah, he was not as a prophet there. And the concept of halal and haram does not apply in that garden. It is only after he eats from the fruit and he comes to this earth, then he becomes the Khalifa of Allah. And it is at that point his being a masoom is crucial. And the whole concept of sin and so on, it's a lengthy debate in itself. So when we talk of an imam or a prophet being masoom, what we are saying is that they have the maturity and the purity of one who has acquired an ego and dissolved it without having actually acquired the ego and dissolved it. Unlike us, who are not given the office of risala or nubuwa or imama, we have to go through that phase. And a newborn child as well, we normally refer to them as masoom. Once they become 2 years, of course, we don't think of them as masoom anymore. Then we have the terrible twos and the so on and so forth. But a newborn, we say he's masoom or she is masoom. That masoom is different. That is the masoom of Adam before he ate from the tree. That is an innocence without the maturity and awareness of knowing what is shaitan. If we were to remain like that, if we had been like Adam was before he ate the fruit, then we would have been pure, but we would not have been able to represent Allah. We would have been like other creation that glorifies Allah, but is not aware of Allah as a human being can be aware. Okay, so in summary then, if not necessary, then it is almost inevitable that every human being will acquire an ego. However, what we can discuss is, why do some children have a stronger ego or nafs than others? And why are some children more identified with this false identity than others? And what can we do as parents to change that? If you can recite a salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. So a little bit of going back to how a child develops a sense of identity. When a child initially is growing up, when it's very young, it learns to imitate words. The parents teaches the child words. And if you observe closely, you will see when they're very young, they don't have a sense of I. And very often, they will refer to themselves in the third person. For example, the child will say, Ali is hungry. Ali wants to sleep. And the child is referring to himself. So there is a third person sense there. And then one fine day, they learn the magic word, I. And with time, as they start believing, this is my toy, and this is my bed, and this is my, then they learn other words like my, mine, me, and so on. And so the more they acquire, they begin to identify with it. And instead of thinking of those things as being their responsibility or something that they should be caring for, they begin to merge it with their own identity and begin thinking this is part of me. They no longer see this as under my care or under my responsibility or for me to look after. Rather, they think this is me at a subliminal level. The lower the sense of confidence in a child, or the more diminished the ego, the more things they will need to supplement their sense of identity. And this they take with them as they grow into adults. So if they had a very lower sense of self, and they're completely identified with the mind as children until they grow old enough to understand, then they will need more friends and more possessions and more things and more worldly material and more hobbies so that they can have more of my, which they take into adults. And then it becomes very important and significant to them, all these my house, my job, my car, my family, my status, my knowledge, my beauty, my this, my that. That my becomes very closely identified with these things. As soon as any of these things are taken away or threatened, the mind, which believes now that the ego has been threatened or compromised, and sees this as a threat of its extinction, it will immediately rush to what it perceives as a threat and try and rescue itself, because it sees as itself being diminished. And it will stop at nothing to regain what it sees as its own destruction. It may vary from simply abusing someone and arguing and blaming, to screaming and shouting, to committing physical violence and torturing and killing another human being. It will stop at nothing. It will even kill another human to protect what it thinks is its own life, when in fact all it is protecting is an illusion and an identity. So as a child, when my toy breaks, it causes considerable suffering. Not because of any intrinsic value to the toy, but because my toy has been broken. If that toy had not been broken or taken away, soon enough the child would have lost interest and moved on and attached itself to another toy. But while it is attached to it, it will suffer considerably as long as it thinks this as being my. And so what I'm trying to say here is that if you're thinking of how this child can be raised without a heavy dependence on this false identity, it really depends on how you behave at home with the child. And the secret to raising a child that has more, that is more likely to surrender to Allah as an adult, is how much you surrender while the child lives with you. And you can take examples from psychologists and they will give you many, many examples. For example, if a child grows up in a home where they're constantly being criticized, then that child will grow up with an inferiority complex, that I'm not good enough. And then it will try and make up for not being good enough by being attached to things. It will need more things to be attached to make up for that sense of diminishment. If a child grows up in a home where the parents overreact to everything, they get emotional about everything, they shout over the most trivial of things, this child will grow up with a lack of tolerance. It will also develop the same habit as an adult. If a child grows up in a home where the parents are extremely strict and the discipline goes beyond necessity, there is over-discipline in the house, then again this child will grow with a lack of tolerance and it will take life too seriously. Every decision in life will be very, very serious, and if it fails, it will feel depressed. If a child was brought up in a home where, for example, money was very important, and when there was something like a penny lost, the parents made a big deal about it, that every penny counted and it was very, very serious, then this child will grow up with this sense of money being very important. So whenever in life any issue of money comes up, you will find that shaitan or that pain body will use that opportunity to press the buttons, because it knows that this human being is sensitive to this issue of money. And so you will find that this human being is always reactive and emotional and displaying negative suffering when it's to do with money, depending on what the parents attached a lot of importance to when they were young. If a child grew up in a home where the father figure was very weak or not present, then it might grow up with a lot of insecurity. And the opposite might be true. If the mother figure is very weak, it might not know how to behave with women, and it might have problems establishing relationships with women in the case of a man. If a child grows up in a home where the parents are always fighting in front of the children, or even if they don't fight, but they have resentment in their hearts for each other, the child will pick up those negative vibes. As a result, it will grow up believing that marriage is not a good thing and that marriage is potentially one of conflict. And so the child will not know how to maintain a relationship. And on the slightest incident or conflict in their own relationship, you will find that they're not able to maintain or overcome that issue. And so when you talk to psychologists, they will give you a lot of such information, which we can tie back to what we have been discussing. Psychologists will tell you, for example, that if a girl grows up in a house where her father was always abusing her mother, she will ironically, as an adult, be attracted to a husband who is also abusive. Or if a boy grows up in a house where the mother is emotionally blackmailing the father or mentally abusing him, then he will be attracted to a wife or a woman who will be of the same kind, who will always be abusive. And so it is fascinating when you study the close relationship between how parents behave and the subtle impact over the years that a child inherits from them. And so you can experiment this for yourself even if you have a newborn child at home. You will see, for example, even a baby, if he's sleeping beside you, if you are restless, if you have a lot of stress in your mind, you will find the baby cannot sleep. They will be restless as well. If you relax, then the baby can relax. So there is, at some subliminal level, that we are communicating and our bodies are giving out a lot more communication than what we speak with our tongues and our mouths. Our hatred, our resentment, our ill feelings is emanating from us towards others without us realizing it. And the opposite is true as well. When we wish well to others, when we have love for others, genuine love, they can sense that love and that sincerity coming from us to others. Now let us say you had a child who was a little older who could understand, but they would have fits of hysteria, and they'd be screaming and crying and shouting and just kicking a fuss, and they were totally out of control. And you realize that this is the formation of the ego, and the child is in some ways being possessed by shaitan, not possessed in the sense that we talk of someone being possessed by the devil, but in the sense that it is out of control. How do you help such a child? You don't necessarily have to solve the problem right away. You could leave the child while they're misbehaving, and then maybe the next day when the child is calm, you could sit with the child and talk to him or her and have a conversation with the child and say, "Do you remember what happened yesterday?" And don't do it as if you are blaming or criticizing or have some anger within you. Do it with love, with awareness. You stay present, you stay aware, and then talk to the child and say, "Do you remember what happened yesterday? What do you think happened? Do you think something overcame you? How did it feel?" And invariably the child will tell you it didn't feel good. And then try and get the child to identify that as being something foreign or alien to itself. Here is a paper and some crayons. Can you draw that thing that overcame you? Does it have a name? And so you teach the child, without trying to make the child schizophrenic or having dual personalities, but you teach the child that whenever it happens again, you have some sort of an understanding. You can say, "Oh, there it comes again," and you have a name for it. And the child, as it grows, will develop this sense that there is something that can overcome me that is negative, that I need to be aware of. So it grows with that sense of awareness that there is me and there is the thinker or that thing that pretends to be the voice in my head. And so the gist of what I'm saying as far as raising children is concerned is that if we as parents can dissolve our egos to some degree, and if we can stay present and alert and be aware that sometimes with the stream of thought that comes through our mind and the chatter in our mind, there is shaitan that possesses us and feeds into those thoughts. And if we can reduce those incidents in our lives, then we will become role models for the children. And the best way to raise these children with a light pain body or a thinner shaitan, if you like, is you yourself to enlighten yourself. Focus on yourself and the child, inshallah, will take care of himself. The other two things that I want to say very quickly about children before I move on is that try and habituate your children to do the dhikr of Allah from the time they're young. In particular, as Shias, we tend to focus a lot on du'as because we have a wealth of du'as from the Ahlul Bayt, alayhi wasalam, which is a great thing. But dhikr is generally easier to do because it doesn't need a book or a lengthy recitation. And it can be simply a phrase. First of all, you as an adult can do a lot of dhikr. You could be driving from home to work, and you could easily recite a few tasbihs of salawat, or you could recite La ilaha illa anta subhanaka inni kuntu min al-zalimin, or do istighfar, and so on. So make that habit in your life. Teach your children to use these phrases that they are taught in the madrasa. Insist that your child does not start eating until they say, A'udhu billahi minash shaitani rajim, bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Insist that your child says, Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen, after eating. Every time something sinful is witnessed, or something wrong, or they do something wrong, insist that they say, Astaghfirullah Rabbi wa atubu ilayh. Or when they sneeze, or to say, if they say, I'm going to do this tomorrow, insist that they say, inshallah. Because we're very good in teaching our children to say, please and thank you. If they don't say please, we immediately, what's the magic word? What's the magic word? And if they don't say please or thank you, we feel, oh, they don't have good akhlaq. Well, in the same way, teach them to say, inshallah. So they learn to trust and to depend on Allah as children. And then when you take out tasbih after your salat, the Allahu Akbar and Alhamdulillah and Subhanallah, when your children are around in particular, do it loudly. So that they, at a subliminal level, will also learn to do the same thing as they grow into adults. And then reading Quran as well. The other thing also is that even though the mind produces an ego, which it sustains, the mind is not bad. As a tool, it is very useful. It is only when we identify with it and we allow the chatter to trick us into thinking it is us, then it is wrong. But as a tool, it is very useful. So use the child's mind as a tool to do analysis. And let the child do some thinking. For example, you might tell them a story about the Ahlul Bayt, like the examples that we had given in the past few nights with regards to Imam Hassan alayhi salam and Imam Al-Baqir alayhi salam, Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad, and how they dealt with the person who was abusing them. Tell the story to the child, and then ask the child to analyze why the Imam behaved like that, why that person behaved like this. What do you think was happening? Can you think of such an example in your own life? Or if you're reading the Quran and you come to these qisas or the stories in the Quran, like for example the story of Yusuf and his brothers, where the Quran talks about how it was shaitan who divided them as brothers and introduced jealousy. Tell them the story of Yusuf and then let them do the analysis and tell you what is happening. And so there are many things that we can do just to bring this sense of alertness and awareness and the child growing to believe what is the true nature of his self or herself and what is alien to him that is coming to him from shaitan. If you can recite salawat, ala Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad. Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad. Okay. Now we move on to a different subject. A couple of nights back, we had said that one of the causes of unhappiness and depression and anxiety is taking life too seriously. And again, as we said, sometimes for how we were brought up, we may come up with that sort of a mindset. When you first realize that things are not as bad as your mind makes them to be, and that your mind tends to exaggerate the seriousness of things, then you find that the sadness and the depression and the anxiety and the unhappiness drops. And at one point in your life, you may come to a realization that is so profound that you might actually laugh out aloud. But that laughter will not be a silly laughter. It will be an intelligent and an enlightened laughter. It will be a laughter that will say, life is not as serious as my mind makes it out to be. The fact that I lost my job, or the fact that I lost some money, or the fact that somebody criticized me, or the fact that somebody hates me, it's not that big a deal as my mind makes it out to be. My mind wants a story. My mind wants a victim identity that it can tell again and again so that it can feed that false identity, which is creating unhappiness that is feeding shaitan. And so at some point, you know, as you talk to other people, you begin to realize that the problems that I have, everybody else in the room has. The depression that I feel when my loved one dies, everybody else has felt that or is going to feel that. And the more you talk to people and interact with them, you begin to realize that it's not Canada or my spouse or my mother or my friend or the Jamaat or Masumin Center, or where I work, or the school I go to, or my home, that is making me unhappy. Rather, it is my thoughts and the ego that is making me unhappy. And so often you will find people using the word, I need, or I must have. I need a break. I need a holiday. I need a new job. I need a bigger home. I need a new wardrobe. I need a new car. And so on. I need my children. I need more money. I need more food. I need more sleep. I need. Try not to use the word I need. Because in reality, your body needs food. Your body has physical needs. There is no doubt about that. But to be happy, the only thing you need is Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. It may be you need Allah through His Messenger and the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. But to be happy, what you need is Allah only. Everything else is not what you need. It is only the suggestion of your mind. And so, you know, people of spirituality will tell you that the mere fact that you say, I need, is the cause of your unhappiness. Because you are then saying, I can't be happy until I get this. And one who is spiritual will train himself to a level where he is so conscious of Allah watching him, and we shall talk more about this tomorrow when we make a conclusion to the series. He is so conscious that Allah is watching him that he or she feels ashamed to say, I need. Allah is watching me and I'm saying, I need this, I must have this, I can't be happy without this. What is Allah saying to me? Am I not sufficient for you? That you need this to be happy? And so you can bring yourself to a level where you will feel ashamed to say that. And so the point to keep in mind is that the ego wants to want more than it wants to have. If I can explain this a little bit more. It wants to want more than it wants to actually acquire what it is saying it wants. Because when it keeps saying it wants, it keeps that ego alive and it is more active. In fact, sometimes it will transfer that wanting from the mind to the body. What is bulimia, for example? What happens when a person will eat and eat and eat and then not feel satisfied? And then they will go to the bathroom and they will, you know, force themselves to throw up all the food and then go and eat again. That hunger is not of the body, it is of the mind. The mind wants to eat. And sometimes we will eat because we are bored. So what happens is that anxiety, that worry, that boredom, that depression, because the mind is not getting enough food for thought, it now transfers that need from being something mental it needs to feed on to something it needs to ingest physically. And so it tries to satisfy that boredom by going to the fridge and trying to eat food in the physical sense. That physical ingestion is a psychological problem, that overeating is because the mind wants to feed. And that's how it transfers it to that. And so it is not the body that is hungry, but the mind. And that is why you will see a lot of times teenagers, they're always dissatisfied. They're always angry. They're always in a state of negativity because they want to want more than they want to have. That they're still at that stage of being confused. They still don't know what they want in life. And they're being driven unconsciously by the ego, not realizing that their true self is asleep. As long as you don't realize this, that you are unconscious and that it is your mind that is driving you, then you will believe every thought that comes to your mind and everything it says to you, and you will identify with it completely. And as long as you do that, you will be condemned to running after happiness from external things. And no matter what you go after, nothing will satisfy you. Rest assured. You can change as many jobs as you want. You can migrate to as many countries as you want. You can change your spouse as many times as you want. You can become the richest man in the world. You can do whatever you want. You will not be happy because the mind does not want things. It wants to want things only. Okay. And the issue is not getting what you want. It is a mental position of always seeking and constant wanting. And that is why you will notice that across ethnicities, across financial backgrounds, across cultures, across religions, even though the things we want might be different, the intensity of the suffering we experience because of not getting what we want tends to be the same. A poor child might want an old used piece of wood that looks like the shape of an animal. A rich child might want an expensive electronic gadget. The things are very different, but the intensity with which they suffer when they don't get what they want is the same. A poor villager in some jungle in Africa who wants a mud hut and can't get it, and that rich man in California who wants the multi-million dollar mansion and can't get it, what they want is very different in price and in value. But the intensity with which they suffer and the dissatisfaction they experience because they can't get what they want is the same. That means from an ego and mind's perspective, there is content and there is structure. The content doesn't matter. The mind doesn't care what it is you want. Is it expensive? Is it cheap? Is it big? Is it small? Is it white? Is it black? Is it made of mud or is it made of gold? What it cares is that you're constantly craving and wanting things because that will constantly keep you dissatisfied and keep that structure alive and keep shaitan feeding from that. And so you realize at some point that the common denominator for all our unhappiness across the globe is not that we don't have what we want, but that we constantly want to have something. And this brings about a great realization. If you think you will get happiness by going to live in another country, then ask yourself, how come the people who are already living there are unhappy? If going to live there causes happiness, then everybody living there should be happy. But they want to come here. If changing your job and going to work for company XYZ will make you happy, then how come the people who are working there are unhappy? If working there is what makes you happy, then everybody there should be delighted and at peace and at tranquility. So you realize it's not having something. It's the mind constantly wanting and being dissatisfied. And that is why we are told in hadith that the love of this world, from Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq, salawatullahi wa salamu alayhi, sallallahu alayhi Muhammad. He says, the love of this world is like drinking sea water, which is salty. The more you drink, the thirstier you become. The more you drink, the thirstier you become until it kills you. And you die with this hasra, with this grief and sorrow that you never got enough. And in another hadith also we are told that people who are attached to things in this world, their greatest suffering will be at the time that they are dying. And when you think about it from the perspective of what we are discussing, you realize that they have attached all these things to their identity as being me. And so when they are dying, they naturally have to separate not only from the things, but from the illusion of me. And as these things are snatched with force one by one, it causes considerable suffering to the soul. A lot of times the suffering to the soul is not the soul leaving the body, but having to be forced to give up that false identity and illusion and to be separated from the illusion of these things. And that is why the Messenger of Allah, peace be on him and his family, said, Mutu kabla anta mutu, Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. He said, die before you die. Experience death of your egos before you experience physical death. Surrender to Allah. And then there is no la khawfun alayhim wa lahum yahzanun. You will not experience any fear nor any grief at the time of your physical death. And the marketing and advertising industry knows this. That in order to sell you things that you don't need, they must convince you that unless you get this or that, your life is unfulfilled. And that your life is not meaningful unless you get this. When you get this, then you will be happy. And if you don't believe me, just watch the ads on TV about cars. In particular, watch those. How this will give you nirvana and your dream comes true, and without this your life is unfulfilled. And okay, they are using this idea of wanting to want. By using this product, you will stand out from the crowd. You will be different from others. And that is what the ego wants. The ego doesn't want to disappear in the mass of the millions of people. The ego wants to be unique, either by being famous or infamous. But I need to survive, and to survive I must stand out from the rest of those who are around me. And so it will look for anything. The same thing with the hankering after brand names and designer labels and so on. A designer label is something expensive, something that is for an exclusive group of elite people, something that not everyone can afford. So by using that, I now become part of an elite group. I now stand up from the rest. If everybody started using that, then I won't want it anymore, because then it has no value. It has value because it makes me different. It makes me stand out. It gives me the idea of being elite. This is not to say that we deny ourselves things. The idea is not denial of things to ourselves, but the problem is when we use these things to identify who we are. When I get my sense of self-worth from these designer names, then there is an issue. Because now my survival depends on me living a certain quality of life and using a certain amount of these brand names. And so when you can no longer feel that connectedness with Allah, which is there, when that connection to Allah is not real to you anymore, you don't feel His presence, then in most likelihood, you will look up for material things to fill up that void and that gap. And the more you feel disconnected from Allah, the more material things you will need to make up for that loss. The more you peel these things off, and the more you feel His presence, the less you will find yourself in need of material things. I must caution, though, that renouncing physical things will not necessarily make you enlightened. Because the ego is very tricky. What it will do is it will find something else to survive and to identify with. For example, now that you are giving up these brand names and you're giving up the money and you're giving up the big home, what the mind will now do is it will create a mental image of yourself as being someone who has transcended all the needs for material things. Now you are this more spiritual person. So now the operating word is still more, except there you are more richer. Now you are more spiritual. So you're still better than others. And the ego doesn't care whether you're living a rich life or a poor life. What the ego cares is that you believe that you need to be more than others. You need to be right and others need to be wrong. And so if you try to just give up physical things, the ego will just quickly adjust and create another identity of yourself. Now you are the muttaqi, the pious ascetic who doesn't need things, and therefore you are better than others and you are more than others. And so it will keep using this. And at some point you might find that an ascetic has a bigger ego than a millionaire. Okay, and this is a common phenomenon. So the idea is not to deny yourself food or physical pleasure or material things in order to free yourself from the ego. That is not going to happen. The idea is to break the identification with it and the dependency on it. Yes, Islam does say you shouldn't collect too much materialism and you shouldn't eat too much and you shouldn't hanker after physical pleasure, but that is only so that you can realize how dependent and identified you are with them. Because you might say, I have a lot of money, but I'm not attached to it. If I have to give it up, I'll give it up. But that's just your saying. When you actually give it up, then you realize how attached you are. So Islam wants you to detach from them, but not because in and of themselves it will free you of the ego, but only so that it brings this awareness and realization of that attachment. And that realization will help you dissolve the ego. I apologize for going a little over time, but I need to finish this, inshallah, so that tomorrow we can make a conclusion. And so if you take away one identity, the ego will quickly replace it with another. Now you become, instead of being the materialist, you become the non-materialist, the non-capitalist, the non-consumerist, the one who fights for Greenpeace, the vegetarian, the environmentalist, and the noble this and the noble that, which is still just the ego operating. And so to surrender to Allah is to say Allah is right, and shaitan and the ego structure that he helped create is wrong. And at one point, you will come to this realization that ultimately the fight is only between Allah and shaitan. And we are simply agents either of Allah or of shaitan. When we are driven by the ego, then we are serving the purpose of shaitan, even if at face value it appears that we are fighting for haqq and for religion. Look at the movement of the Kharijites, the Khawarij, who stood up against Amir al-Mu'mineen, and what were they fighting for? At face, zahiri value, they were fighting for Allah. They were fighting for Islam. But who are they serving? They were serving shaitan. So the fight is between Allah and between shaitan. The more our actions are done in a surrendered state, the more they are for Allah. And the more they are done to uphold the ego, to prove I am right and you are wrong, at any cost, and with hatred and discrimination. Unjust hatred, not just. Okay, because somebody again asked me about tawalla and tabarra, but we won't get into that right now. And so, you know, we need to be aware of this. So in conclusion then we say, how do we give up attachments? You don't really give up attachments by doing something. You give up attachments by initially just realizing that you are attached to something. It may not be something physical, it may be a position. Maybe you were holding a certain position, maybe you had a certain rank, and then you lose that. If that results in you then backbiting or trying to bring someone down or wishing ill for someone, then you know that that is driven by the ego. If that helps you in then joining hands and helping, then that is driven by surrender, and it was done for the sake of Allah. If I can give an analogy, that will clarify it very easily so that you understand what we mean by how you break attachment. If there is darkness in the room, how do you remove darkness? You don't suppress the darkness. You don't fight the darkness. It is impossible. What you do is you introduce light. When you introduce light, the darkness disappears. But you can't fight the darkness itself. How do you deal with ignorance? You can't fight ignorance or suppress ignorance or take ignorance out of your heart and throw it. What you do is you don't deal with ignorance. You just realize you're ignorant. You introduce knowledge. When knowledge comes in, ignorance dissolves. In the same way, you can't suppress the ego or fight it or give up material things or deny your body its physical needs so that the ego is suppressed or broken or removed. You can't. What you do is you bring awareness and realization and ma'rifat of Allah, and you become aware that I am not the thinker. When awareness comes in, the ego dissolves. So what we need to do is introduce something, not try and remove anything. What is there in our hearts is darkness and ignorance. As soon as Allah comes in, as soon as awareness comes in, as soon as realization comes in, then that automatically dissolves. And shaitan now is there, but he does not have any more control over that mind. As the ayat we said yesterday, لَأُغْوِيَنَّهُمْ أَجْمَعِينَ إِلَّا عِبَادَكَ مِنْهُمُ الْمُخْلَصِينَ. So as a first step we say, to remove these attachments and the ego, we need to be aware, just bring to mind that I am not the thinker, and watch the mind as it plays games. And then tomorrow, inshallah, we will build on that and say then the next step is the dhikr of Allah and how we change from being distracted to being focused on Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So tomorrow, inshallah, we'll make a few more points and then make a conclusion to the whole series, inshallah. And we'll stop here. Tonight being Thursday night, with your permission, I will take a few more minutes so that we can remember Imam Hussain alayhi salam. If you can recite salawat ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Ya ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. We see that in Karbala as well, the women that we want to pay tribute today, since we have talked about children, that the women in Karbala as well, even though they loved their children and they were attached to them, when it was time to give up their children for the sake of Islam, because they were closer to their state of surrender, they were willing to give up their children for Allah. They did not say, my child, how will I live without my children? Islam was the first priority. Allah was the first priority. But at the same time, we see that the love of a mother never fails you. And that is why Islam emphasizes, love your mother, respect your mother, cherish your mother, know the value of your mother. Because you will only know her value after she passes away. When Musa alayhi salam's mother passes away, he cries before Allah. And Allah tells him, O Musa, you have every right to cry for your mother. But O Musa, now watch your back when you go to Fir'aun. Because your mother used to wake up in the middle of the night and pray to me and say, O Allah, look after my Musa. That dua of your mother is not with you anymore. So value the dua of your mother. It stays with you even long after she is gone. And so we see the same thing in Karbala again and again. And that is why you will see in the incidents of Karbala, at many, many places we are told that the mother of Imam Hussein has an appearance and there is a vision of her. That even when Imam Hussein alayhi salam is alone, you will see Fatima is there for Hussein. Hamid ibn Muslim says that when Ali al-Akbar was leaving for the final time, the door or the flaps of the tent would lift and fall and lift and fall, as if there is a mother standing behind there. She is letting her son go for Islam, but there is that love of the mother that does not go. That is why Allah, even though His love is infinite, He quantifies it when He compares it to the love of a mother. And He says, my love is 70 times the love of your mother. On one hand, He is showing how much He loves us, but on the other hand, He is showing the love of a mother, that it can be quantified against the infinite love of Allah. So now think about the mother of Ali al-Asghar. And I end with this, that even Hurmala says that when he had this arrow in his hand and he was trying to pierce the throat of Ali al-Asghar, his hands were trembling. And on one narration we are told that when he was asked by Umar ibn Sa'ad, O Hurmala, why is your hand trembling? He said, at the tent I can see a woman standing looking at me, as if Rabab is saying, Hurmala, do not kill my little baby. What has my Asghar done to you? And we, our salams to Imam Hussein, that he recognizes this even after Asghar is killed. And that is why 7 times he goes back and forth thinking, how will I take this baby to its mother? Inna lillahi wa inna ilayhi raji'un, he says. Ridham bi qada'ihi wa tasliman li amri. O Allah, I surrender to your decree and I resign to your will.
على لعنة الله على القوم الظالمين وسيعلم الذين ظلموا أي منقلب ينقلبون إلهي بحق محمد وأنت المحمود وبحق علي وأنت الأعلى وبحق فاطمة وأنت فاطر السماوات والأرض وبحق الحسن وأنت المحسن وبحق الحسين وأنت قديم الإحسان وبحق تسعة المعصومين من ذرية الحسين يا الله يا الله يا الله يا الله. Oh Allah, this is the last Thursday night of this holy month of Ramadan. O Allah, we do not know who amongst us will be alive this next month, next year in Ramadan. We ask you, O Allah, for the sake of this blessed night and this blessed month, O Allah, forgive our sins this night. O Allah, bihaqqi Muhammad wa ali Muhammad, forgive the sins of all our marhumin and give shifa to all those who are ill on this month. O Allah, keep us united as a community and let this day be a day of, let the day of Eid be a day of rejoicing and of unity amongst all of us. O Allah, hasten the appearance of our Imam and make us amongst his Ashab and Ansar. Rabbana taqabbal minna innaka anta as-sami'ul alim. Salawatullah.